listening? It is I, Numator479. According to our studies of your puny mammalian race, we discovered you like very good coffee. And while it is our evolutionary purpose to cause you psychic torment, we want you awake and vivacious to give it. So try our new blend from Spring Hill Jack Coffee, Reptilian in the Morning. Our proprietary blend of lightly roasted cacao husks will have you immediately energized upon emerging from the pain cloaca with all your slippery new eggs. Thanks, honey. Hot, I'm cold-blooded. Thanks to Spring Hill Jack and Last Podcast on the Left, I'm ready to get out there and eat some babies. Get out of the way, Hillary Clinton.
There's no place to escape to.
This is the Last Podcast on the Left.
Right from your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. I don't like Thanksgiving.
You're alone here. You're alone here. You're alone in the studio. Thanksgiving is wonderful because there's no Jesus Christ.
Welcome to Last Podcast on the Left, everybody. I'm Marcus Parks here with glutton Henry Zebrowski.
I love to sit with my family and sup. I love to sup, but hopefully you've already consumed your meal, all right, because we're going to talk about, after 2 weeks episode to go, I don't know. I'm still queen. We just recorded Necrophilia.
Yeah, we did just record it. We're getting everything out of the way before the holidays come.
But
we did just record Necrophilia yesterday.
Yeah, I just can't wait. And I was like looking up, I was like, yam recipes yesterday. And it's been like, oh man, I just got. And I was reading all about Harold Schechter's new book, Murderabilia, which we're going to be talking to him today in an exclusive interview.
Yeah.
But I forgot about the acid bath killer.
Yeah, the acid bath killer is incredible.
Just turning somebody into soup.
Yeah. Turned many people into soup. Did you get to read about the guy who owned the sausage factory and put his wife into the sausage mixer and they didn't find it until all the sausage had already gone out?
That's fun.
Yeah. Everyone got real upset in Chicago.
Yeah,
sausage sales plummeted.
God, that must have been hard for the economy, that entire city.
Well, yeah, the acid bath killer. He was the one that said I killed him, but you ain't got no body. Ain't got no crime.
And you're like, you just confessed to murder.
Yeah, and then
murders.
They found quite a bit of evidence back at his house. He's like, I forgot to rent out that bucket.
Oh, no. And this is where an eye for detail really comes in. But today, we have a very special Thanksgiving episode. We have one of our mentors.
Yes.
In true crime. He's here to talk with us about his new book, Murderabilia, and his new project, upcoming projects, and his thoughts on why he doesn't feel shame about loving true crime.
And none of you should feel shame about loving true crime. I don't feel any shame about loving true crime.
No.
Henry feels shame about nothing.
Almost nothing. It's more personal. It's more on the inside. Again, I saw myself getting out of the tub the other day.
Yeah? Man. You still got the frogman thing going on?
Nice. Don't look good. Don't look good. But are you ready for the sultry tones of Harold Schechter?
Here he is.
Right from your grave.
So here we are. With Harold Schechter, the patron saint of Last Podcast on the Left.
Our benefactor. Our contributor. You don't know. You are a contributor. I'm sorry.
I'm very honored. I mean, you guys have kind of made me a celebrity among some group of social misfit-like young people who are coming to me all the time. Yeah, so I'm very grateful for that. So.
You're welcome.
Well, it's so you are grateful. Good. I was worried that you weren't.
Good. They at least they buy books. You know what I mean? They're all book readers. Everybody, but it's also, I think, one of the coolest parts about our audience is that they love the information. So they're going for it, and nobody does it better than you.
Well, I truly am moved and appreciate that. That means a great deal to me.
Of course. We've talked about it before, about you being such a huge influence on the podcast, because what I love about your writing is that you find this line where it's like it's lurid up to a point, but still being very respectful,
And that's what we're trying to figure out.
Well, the material is so inherently sensational.
Yeah.
And sensationalistic that I felt, you didn't have to play that up. You just, you know, report it. You know, understatement in a way is the best way of communicating how horrible it was, you know, just letting the facts speak for themselves without using over the top lurid language or whatever. So, yeah. That was a deliberate stylistic choice.
But that's also one of the things that I think sets you apart from a lot of other true crime writers is that you don't shy away from the detail. You give the detail as it is, no matter how horrible it is, you know, especially like, you know, with say your book on Albert Fish, you pull no punches at any point.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, with Fish, you just had to quote from his letters.
Sure.
But you know, with Fish, I mean, it was particularly important to communicate, you know, how monstrous he was. You know, I think there are many people, myself included, who do regard him as the most, again, it's hard to gauge these things, but because his victims were children and because he took such joy in torturing them, you know, it's hard not to think of him as possibly the most monstrous serial killer the country has produced. So.
And he should be proud of that, wherever he is. I hope he's looking down. Him and Beethoven and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I hope that they're having a good time.
Well, you know, I'm not entirely sure they're all in the same place, but I'm sure he'd be, you know, happy to be counted as the most monstrous, sadistic sex murderer, in our country's history.
God, he'd be jealous of new guys. Before we talk about your new book, Murderabilia, which is great. Great. Love this book.
So good.
I want to ask just a general question about just kind of decades spent wading through true crime.
Yeah, because us ourselves, we're about 15 years into it.
Yes.
We're still relative newbies when it comes to really just living in the world of true crime all the time.
Yeah. How does it feel? Because I feel like we're watching another, which is now you have documented many times. We were in a waxing period for true crime, and now we're in a waning period for true crime. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. I would say, but it feels like more so it's not as red hot as it was like 3 years ago. Like, what does it do to you? Like as a man, like when you are researching this material, like, and your relationships, like, does it wear upon you? Like, does it, like, as each cycle comes and goes, watching people be super into true crime and then be like, true crime's horrible. Like, what do you like? Kind of how do you deal with that? Is, or are you just so deep in your own work that you don't, you know?
Well, I mean, I haven't really paid attention, you know, to any particular cycles in terms of true crime's popularity. But, you know, as I'm sure you know from my own writings as well as other sources, you know, people have always been fascinated by true crime. I mean, there's always, you know, an audience for true crime going back probably, you know, before the invention of the Gutenberg press. You know, in terms of murder ballads and stuff, you know, this recent kind of, I wouldn't even say research, this explosion of interest in it, you know, caught me by surprise. When I first started writing true crime, I may have mentioned this to you in some earlier podcasts, you know, it was considered such a sub-literary genre.
Yeah.
That I couldn't persuade my publisher, Simon & Schuster at the time, to publish my Ed Gein book in hardcover, you know, because even though Capote's book had come out, you know, a couple of decades before, you know, it was still, again, regarded as a subliterary thing. And also the received wisdom at that time was that no one was interested in reading about old murder cases.
Incorrect. Hey, whoever said that, it was very wrong.
Yeah. Well, it was proved wrong.
More in terms of waning, I mean more just kind of cultural. Now there's more people doing the true crime's inappropriate again. Like, we're heading back into the Tipper Gore times about true crime in many ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always that pendulum. I mean, I'm not surprised by that. You know, true crime is, I think it stirs up very dangerous, fearful impulses in people. You know, part of the function of true crime is to allow us to vicariously ventilate very taboo and forbidden impulses within ourselves. You know, I have this anthology, True Crime and American Anthology, I'm very proud of, published by the Library of America, which traces the history of true crime publications really from the Puritan times. But the introduction to the book, I begin by quoting Plato. And Plato says, "The virtuous man is content to dream what the wicked man really does."
Yeah.
Jeez.
And, you know, the point of that quote is, you know, that all of us possess these dark, taboo, forbidden, unacknowledged fantasies and impulses. And true crime allows civilized, law-abiding people to ventilate those things in some kind of safe, socially acceptable way. But the point is, you know, it does stir up, you know, thoughts and dreams and, as I say, you know, taboo impulses that make people very, very uncomfortable. So, yeah, it's not at all surprising at some point that there's going to be a reaction against the fascination with true crime.
Sure.
You know, it's going to be condemned. It's going to be seen, you know, as some sign of the moral decay of society. Again, that there are always going to be these moral crusaders who launch these campaigns against popular forms of entertainment that, you know, really in a way disturb something in themselves that they can't deal with. So,
I like that, because that's the thing. It's causing thoughts in your head that you can't handle, and the rest of us are over it. I mean, I got 5 long stem roses in my butt right now. But that's just, again, that's just a concentrate for the interview.
Yeah. Well, I think you would have been closer to Albert Fish if you had them up your urethra.
I mean, I'm working. Fingers crossed I get there by Christmas. Yeah. I got to do something for my family.
Make sure the thorns are still on.
So do you see like any pattern throughout history as far as like when true crime waxes, when it becomes more popular or when it becomes less popular? Or is it just sort of up to the fates?
You know, I think it's always had a certain level of popularity. You know, again, if you look at any moment in the history of Western, you know, modern Western civilization, and by modern Western civilization, you know, I'm going back to the 1700s, you know, you see this flood of true crime pamphlets every time a sensational murder happened. You know, in our own country, you know, well, you see in Murderabilia, you know, I reproduce some of the, like, Jesse Pond Murray true crime pamphlets.
Yeah.
And, you know, the knife, you know, which are illustrated with, you know, to us, the illustrations look very quaint. But to an audience in 1860, you know, those would have been shockingly graphic images, you know, of Jesse Pomeroy slitting this little girl's throat. You know, in the 1930s and 1940s, the newsstands of America were packed with all these true detective magazines, you know, which ran very, very lurid and graphic stories. So there's always been that. You know, it's a little, you know, it's a little, what's happened over the last few years with this great explosion of interest in true crime is kind of an anomalous in a sense. I can't remember any particular period, you know, where it's captured the public's attention to that extent.
Yeah. It's entered the mainstream, like fully entered, like Ryan Murphy. You know what I mean? Showrunners of like big time television shows that are obsessed with true crime. I go into meetings. This is real. Where like I'll have meetings with like big time producers and they're all like, "Tell me more about what Jeffrey Dahmer did."
Yeah.
And I was being like, this was used to get me kicked out of meetings.
Right. Well, I think part of it's just technological, you know, that the means of transmitting these stories now has changed so much, and it's much easier for people to feed their appetite for this kind of material and even to acknowledge their appetite for it, you know, without being made to feel ashamed. Though again, you know, as we're kind of talking about, I mean, the guilt eventually does come up. So
people, yeah. People who don't get it.
You know, you know what it could be. I just realized is that you say the technological aspect of it. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that a lot of true crime content, you used to have to read to get it.
Yeah. And now you don't. Yeah, you have to find the books.
Yeah, you have to find the books, and you'd have to actually sit down and read an entire book. But
is this about Zoomers? Are we about to talk about quiet quitting?
And you had to buy the books.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think to my mind, I could be totally wrong. What set the whole true crime craze off was the podcast Serial.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you know, that show Jinx about Durst.
I mean, that was just lightning in a bottle.
Yeah. But I mean, Serial, you know, because it was so respectable. Oh, I have very mixed feelings about Eric Larson's Devil in the White City, as I'm sure you know. Drew very heavily on my own book. But the way I always thought of that book was that he made true serial killer stuff safe for women's book clubs.
Yeah.
No, because embedding the home story in the story about the building of the Chicago World's Fair, you know, you could read about H.H. Holmes while feeling you are learning something cultural.
Sure. Something safe.
You're learning something cultural, but on this other, you know, on this other level, again, you're getting to feed, you know, the philosopher William James talks about the carnivore within.
Yeah.
The carnivore within. You're getting to throw a piece of red meat to the carnivore within. Without even knowing, you know, that it's there. So, yeah.
See, I've seen a lot of ladies express it. But I will say that's kind of why, you know, it is both who we are as people, but it's also a part of our show, which is we understand. It's like we used to joke about how you have to get through the jokes to get to our information. Yeah. Like you have to handle, like we're ghouls.
Yeah.
And the proper tradition, I think, of true crime is just both being deadly serious about the information, but also kind of reveling a little bit and understanding that this is naughty. And we are, that it's kind of where it should in many ways kind of remain. Like it should be not in the center of the pipe of entertainment. It's probably best if it's a little bit on the fringe.
Yeah, but I think entertainment is the key word. You know, people are reluctant to admit, you know, that true crime, you know, watching, you know, the Jeffrey Dahmer miniseries or whatever is a kind of entertainment. You know, you ask people why they do it, you know, and they rationalize their answers. Well, I'm interested in learning about, you know, abnormal psychology, blah, blah, blah. You know, what they're not willing to admit, you know, is that they're enjoying it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like it. You just kind of like it.
Yeah. That it's entertaining. There used to be a zine. I don't know if you're aware of it. You know, if you remember, I mean, now there are all these e-zines, but back in the day.
I remember zines.
Yeah. So there was one called Murder Can Be Fun.
Murder Can Be Fun. I loved Murder Can Be Fun. I used to buy it at Desert Island, Brooklyn. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. So, but you know, the title kind of says it all. People.
Yeah, exactly. That's us. That's what we do. But that actually probably brings us to Murderabilia, where I think that you somehow, in an academic sense, still nail that tone. You nail that. It's where we are fascinated by this, and it is okay to be fascinated by this. And the way you break it down, because, you know, the run up of the book is it's a history of true crime in objects.
100 objects.
And I love this. I love this concept of boiling it down to these kind of like famous totems that represent massive stories.
Yeah. I mean, so did you, when you were writing this book, did you start with the story or start with the object for each one?
Kind of with the objects. I mean, you know, I obviously, if you're writing a history of crime, you know, there are certain crimes you feel you have to cover. I mean, there were certain crimes I wanted to cover that I couldn't find any suitable objects to, you know, and I didn't want to, you know, have every object be, you know, this is the weapon that so-and-so used, and this is the weapon so-and-so used. You know, I was looking for a variety of interesting objects. So, yes, in many cases, it was, you know, finding what I thought was an intriguing and interesting object connected to the crime that led me to focus on that particular crime. So
the footstool with the Lindbergh baby was really interesting. I also did not know that the ladder with the Lindbergh baby was really interesting. I did not understand. I don't know as much about the case as I wanted to.
Yeah.
I didn't fully understand that there was discrepancy over the guy that they named as the killer of the baby. I did not know that.
You know, there's always been a lot of controversy over whether Bruno Richard Hauptmann, you know, was actually the Lindbergh baby kidnapper. I mean, you know, I feel pretty sure he was. And, you know, I think the weight of evidence indicates that he was. But yeah, but I mean, there have been people, you know, who've written books arguing, you know, pointing to other suspects. But the ladder was one of the key pieces of evidence against him. You know, he was a carpenter. He made this homemade ladder, which he used to snatch the baby, you know, from the second story nursery room in New Jersey.
And technically, that's like a Looney Tunes tactic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like Wile E. Coyote.
Yeah. Well, you know, he did it. He almost kind of got away with it. But but it was these wood experts who were able to match the wood from the ladder to these missing boards in Hauptmann's attic, you know, that, you know, help convict him. So
I did appreciate in your book how you put wood experts in quotations.
Yeah, because like, yeah, it just sounds like, yeah, a lumberjack shows up and like, I know wood. Like, oh, great.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, again, some controversy surrounds it. But, you know, that's a very, very famous piece of murderabilia. I should say, by the way, again, I do in the book, the term murderabilia, coined by a gentleman named Andy Kahan, who works for a victims unit in Houston. I was actually on John Walsh years ago of America's Most Wanted, briefly had a daytime talk show, and I was invited to be on with Andy Kahan on this subject. Andy, by the way, coined the term. I mean, he's violently against you know, anything having to do with murderers profiting, you know, justified sure. from their infamy, you know, by selling things and so on. You know, I was there to point out, as I do in my book, you know, that it's not at all a modern phenomenon, you know, that, you know, people every time in the past, and again, going back at least to the 1700s, that, you know, a horrible, sensational murder happened, hordes of people would flock to the site and want to come away with some sort of morbid souvenir.
I always think of the Bell Gunna site when I think about that.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the Bell Gunna site, I mean, the Sunday after her murder farm, you know, the bodies on her murder farm, the dismembered, lonely Norwegian bachelors that she lured to the site.
God, she must have been something in the sack. I think about that, like, about, because she kept, these men were thirsty for her, and she was built like an offensive line.
Okay, first of all, I have to say that, so one of the Amazon reviews, so, you know, in my book, I describe her, you know, she was.
Yeah.
You know, she was 200 foot. Anyway, one of the reviews.
Yeah, she's a lot of lady.
Yeah. Anyway, one of the reviews said I was fat phobic.
if we're gonna talk about it with anybody, at least do it with the serial killer. I think we can talk. It's not Oprah, you know.
But thousands of people. I mean, they were running, you know, special trains from Chicago, you know, for all the sightseers. Thousands of people. There are postcards. You know, they put the decaying remains of her victims initially in a little outbuilding on the farm. And there are photographs of hundreds of people, men, women, and children. You know, it looks like the line outside the Pirates of the Caribbean or something, you know, just lining up so they could walk past and see these, you know, decomposing remains. So.
And, you know, that's funny. Like, I have noticed that in a fair amount of story, like, as we've been going a little bit more historical with true crime lately, and I've been noticing that showing up a fair amount that showed up. We just did the Madame LaLaurie story down in New Orleans. And they did the same thing where they would display.
But that was also at a protest too.
Yeah, but they, but in the same, you know, I guess natures, like they would display the dead bodies for people to come and look at, like almost as if it was the public's right to see these things.
Well, back in the Old West, as I'm sure you probably know, you know, they would put the corpses of outlaws that had been captured or killed on display, that had been hanged or, you know, shot to death. You know, that the Clint Eastwood movie, Unforgiven, which, you know, the end, you know, when he rides into town, he sees Morgan Freeman's body on display, and that sets off his last rampage. You know, but that was very, very typical in the Old West. And sometimes, you know, they would put body parts on display. And, you know, I think I say in my book, in 19th century dime museums, there was a famous one in New York called the Museum of Anatomy. They would put, you know, the New York one had the preserved arm of Anton Probst, you know, one of the most horrific mass murderers of the 19th century, you know, on display in this dime museum. And they would advertise it in the newspapers as a big draw. So
that's why I always disagreed when Charles Manson freaked out towards the end of his life when he had that was star, right? They had that girl move in who was trying to kind of move in on his game. And then he found out that she was just angling to get his body to take it on tour after his death. And honestly, I was like, that would have been awesome.
Yeah,
I would have paid money to go see Charles Manson on tour. Charles Manson live. You know what I mean? You just have a couple, you know, Slash comes out, plays a couple. I mean, like, you know, and you pop up the bit. Like, to be honest, if you're a serial killer, what more would you want?
Yeah.
So you would advertise it as Charles Manson live?
Live! And then he's dead. You put into parentheses? Like, you know, like right now, he's dead.
Live from your grave.
How can I even ask, like, how do you feel about just kind of murderabilia in general now? Like, I've never purchased a piece of murderabilia.
Neither have I.
I've never spent money. Most of the stuff I've gotten, you know, I have a Gacy drawing. I have some stuff from Charles Ng. I have some stuff from Ted Bundy. I have some stuff just, you know, from, and, but it's kind of just showed up at my house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, you don't really know where it comes from. Like, I've got a drawing from Richard Ramirez. I've got a letter from BTK. Yeah. Again, I didn't pay for any of this stuff. That just ended up in my possession.
What do you have?
What do I have? Well, one of the things I have that's in the book, that's actually kind of a treasured possession of mine, is this beautiful hand-carved wooden box that had been made by Robert Irwin, the Mad Sculptor.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wrote a book about him called The Mad Sculptor. Irwin was a very talented artist, totally crazy, who committed this very, very, very sensational triple murder in New York City in 1937, Easter Sunday, 1937. And he was in and out of mental institutions. And when he was incarcerated in them, he would make a little money for the hospital canteen by either sculpting busts of the doctors and nurses and attendants and selling them for a few dollars. Or in this case, he carved this beautiful wooden box. You know, he made the box, he carved it, and each side of the box and the lid of the box is decorated with a bas-relief carving of this naked woman who was this young model named Ronnie Gideon, who was one of the victims he killed.
Jesus.
Whoa.
After my book came out, this very sweet woman from down south contacted me and said, you know, my husband was a guard at one of the mental institutions that Irwin was an inmate in, and he bought this box from him. And her husband was deceased. You know, I think he'd want you to have it. So I, you know, offered to purchase it from her and flew her to New York and, you know, have this box, which is, you know, really quite an amazing piece of artwork, actually. So
do you use it?
Do I
is
use
there
it
stuff now? In it?
The only thing that's in it is the original letter she sent me describing what it was. But no, I do not use it. You know, it's an objet d'art as the...
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. You know, I have a couple of other things. I have a watercolor that somebody gave me from Lawrence Bittaker, I think.
Wow.
I also acquired, actually, in doing my book, an inscribed hymnal from the former Son of Sam, who is now, I think, calling himself the Son of Light.
Yeah, the Son of Light.
The Son of Hope.
I wish that we could be... he won't talk about... I wanted to get in contact with David Berkowitz, but he only will talk about Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he did... I do have a book that is a lot of his poetry that he's written over the years. And it does have a fair amount of Christian poetry, but then there's other poems. Like there was one poem, it's just called The F Train. And it's about how much he doesn't like the F train.
The F train. It never works. How am I supposed to get to work? Like, yeah, he was one of the worst. He is the worst.
I take the F train all the time.
breaks the headlines. Harold Schechter is pro F train.
but yeah, I mean, there is something, you know, as I say in the introduction to the book, you know, I've always been fascinated about, you know, the kind of power that emanates, you know, from these items, you know, and why people are so drawn to them and why people want to have them in their households. You know, again, I see them as the shadow side of saints' relics, you know, just as some sort of divinity inheres to a saint's relic, to a piece of bone or whatever of a saint. There's some, you know, there's some a dark quality of evil that we're drawn to. In fact, I've come to think, okay, I'm going to run this by you. You're the first people I've spoken to about this. I've come to think that a lot of the fascination with serial murders and true crime, there's a weird quasi-religious quality to it.
I can see it. Yes, if you want to speak on, I can respond.
Yeah, but let me just say, you know, one of the central issues of theology, in a letter, I don't want to get too pedantic, but in a letter to his father, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, you know, said in Latin, "Unde malum," whence evil? You know, where does evil come from? You know, it's a mystery, you know, that religion has always grappled with and essential to religion. And, you know, I think somehow people are partly drawn, you know, to these true crime documentaries and podcasts, you know, because it confronts you with that age-old question, you know, of the nature of evil, you know, the source of evil, the existence of evil. So, you know, there's something about that in owning a piece of murderabilia. And I also think there's some primitive thing going on. You know, it's like, you know, evil fighting evil, you know, like people who wear the evil eye or something, you know, all these superstitions that if you carry around some token of evil, it will ward off other evil. Anyway, I mean, those are just, you know, theories that I've been playing around with.
I wonder if people view, quote unquote, holy good people, saints. I love this connection of murderabilia to like saints, like objects, religious objects, because I think that there's, on one hand, if you believe in God, like if you believe in that, this idea that there's some pure good in this world, a saint is someone that knows something about that world that we'll never know. They have some form of intimate knowledge of this purity of God that we are, or people who want that, are desperately chasing and looking for, and also just kind of curious about, like, thing in general. I mean, like, how do you go, like, because a lot of them started as people, just normal people. How did they become a saint? How did you become this other thing that became like deified in a way? You got touched by this energy, and there's a connection to it. I think that there's on the other side, there's a transgressive version of that, which is those guys, as much as we make fun of them as losers, and they are, and it's again, we do believe that serial killing essentially, is also born of an extreme mediocrity. It's because you're not good at really anything else. You can choose this other thing that then you can get an instant name for yourself by destroying a bunch of people's lives. But I think there's something in that, that they have crossed over to a world that we will never see. You know, like they have done thing. They have done the most taboo. They've stepped into an extreme taboo. And the thing, in some ways, there's a curiosity about, yes, like, whence evil, right? Like, what made you go do that? But also, like, there is something about you. That means there's something inside. There's something, there's an experience that you had that I will never understand.
Well, it may also be a case of, like, it's a lot easier to touch the devil than it is to touch God.
He's there. He's wanting, his pants are down.
And if you're wanting to get into something that, you know, supernatural or something extra-normal or anything like that, something religious, then, you know, if you believe in God, therefore you must believe in the devil. And it's a lot easier to touch someone who's touched bad. Much easier to do bad than good.
I think about Gacy, and I think about guys that are, like, true villains of American history, right? Like, not just, like, low, like, murderers or mass murderers, but like those guys that are like, we know, you know, John Wayne Gacy, upon rewatching his stuff, there was like, I had a re-interest in him not that long ago. And he was a guy that I believe was probably one of the worst predators that ever walked the face of the planet.
Yeah, I agree.
But there's something about, like, what was it like in that rumpus room on a Wednesday between these murders, where you're walking on top of this pile of your own bodies that you have created that are in your home. You got the fucking pogo costume hanging in a closet. You know what I mean? Like, this guy has become, it's a demon kind of walking the earth in a way. And so there's something about something that guy touched that then now you're like, oh wow, this is imbued with something, and I don't know whether I like it or not, but I'm endlessly fascinated by it. Well, a lot of it, you know, being like, you know, I don't want to be there. I don't want to be in that place, but, like, holy shit, what would that be like?
Yeah. Absolutely. By the way, speaking of murder, Billy and Gacy, I know somebody who actually showed me this, who owns, and it's signed by him, John Wayne Gacy's Bob Ross Learn How to Paint Kit.
Well, he also had what's his butts. He had guys working for him. He had guys doing the paintings for him. He had other guys, like, he had everybody. There was like an assembly line. I went to a showing of a bunch of his art, and they just showed, like, he did a whole series of the Seven Dwarves, but they were all just paint by number sets, and he'd just sign them and then ship them.
So. But, you know, apparently Bob Ross was a big influence on his artistic development.
Love to see that conversation.
So this is like religious element. Is this sort of an outcropping of, like, kind of the new revelations that you had when you revisited Ed Gein for, have you heard what Eddie Gein done?
Yeah, I mean, I felt, you know, it's so inexplicable, you know, phenomenon like Ed Gein. But I mean, what I came to believe is that all the psychic pressures that were brought to bear on him opened up some kind of fissure, you know, in his deep psyche. And all of this weird, archaic stuff just came pouring out. And he was enacting, you know, these kinds of, you know, very, 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 atavistic rituals of human sacrifice, and again, flaying human skin and so on and so forth. You know, it's one of the sources, I think, of the fascination that surrounds Gein, you know, because you have, you know, this guy living in 1950s, you know, the American heartland in the 1950s, you know, the rest of us are there watching Leave It to Beaver on TV, so on and so forth. And he's in this little remote farmhouse acting out, you know, these very bizarre, you know, very bizarre rituals, which would have been, again, familiar to Aztec priests and stuff.
So weird.
You know, there is some element of that. You know, given the materialistic society we live in, you know, the very secular society we lived in, you know, still on some level, you know, we believe in these cosmic forces of, you know, love versus evil, you know, that are always at war with each other. And, you know, as you were saying, you know, there are on the one hand, the saints' relics, which resonate with this quality of self-sacrifice and utter selflessness and, you know, love. And then the shadow side of that, this murderabilia stuff, which resonates with all this satanic meaning.
Oh. It's cool.
It's incredible.
It's pretty cool. Die from your
grave. Now that we've arrived on the subject of Ed Gein once more, like we were both on a new MGM Plus documentary series about Ed Gein, in which we all got to hear Ed Gein's voice for the very first time. Among the first people on earth to hear Ed Gein's voice, you know, since he died. What did you, what was your first thought upon hearing Ed Gein's voice? Like after spending, arguably, you are the Ed Gein expert amongst experts. You know more about him than anyone. You've spent more time with him than anyone. Like, how did you feel upon hearing that voice? What did you think?
Well, when he first heard it, you know, he just sounded like a regular guy.
That's the thing. That's what's weird, man. He sounds like he's just, it's just like
for some reason, you know, for various reasons, partly because in my researches, reading about people who knew him, you know, he was always, I had the impression of him as being a little, I don't know if this is still, you know, an acceptable word. Do people use the word effeminate anymore? But effeminate.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. But yeah, he does. He was, you know, yeah.
But you know, but so I was almost expecting to hear that a little in his voice. But yeah, there was none of that. He was just like this regular farmer guy.
Yeah. You know what? I think a rural American, not even a Wisconsin accent. That's what was weird to me is that you just had this regular, yep, I just went on and I found her and I did it. Yeah. And that's just, I did it.
I actually wonder if it's a part of his, cause like these guys, right? They all kind of have, some of these guys have cloaking mechanisms, you know, like they have these things where, you know, they have families, so they have, you know, and they, you see, look, no, I'm normal. You know, I got this other stuff going on. Well, I wonder if that's just his way. It's like how I'm trying to learn about football so I could talk to men, right? Because I got nothing to talk about except aliens and serial killers. So I'm learning to try to, I use football. I'll go like, you know, the Cowboys, huh? And that works. Where I wonder if Ed Gein affected more of a,
tougher accent.
Yeah, I don't think it was an affectation. I mean, you know, I think, you know, when he wasn't robbing graves and dissecting corpses and dressing up in, you know, flayed skin and so on, you know, he was leading, you know, this kind of regular Plainfield, Wisconsin life.
So. I'm just a regular guy, just like you. Let me feel your sides. Let me just see. Oh, yeah. Let me show it. What's your waist? But yeah, he is. Yeah. But otherwise, he's just a regular guy.
Yeah.
God.
You know, obviously none of his neighbors. Well, of course, you couldn't really imagine anything.
That's the thing is that when you're in the, he's in the Willy Wonka chocolate factory. You know what I mean? No one knows what's going on in there. And the Oompa Loompas are afraid.
Yeah. Well, you know, people would sometimes ask me, you know, didn't some of his neighbors suspect? But, you know, I mean, who would
suspect what?
He's grave robbing. He's wearing human skin. He's dancing in a field. Like they probably would, they'd lock you up.
Yeah. For even suggesting it.
There was a great, you know, the satirical newspaper, The Onion.
Yeah.
So they had this great headline years ago. Neighbor said she always suspected that the man living next door was a serial killer. And she, you know, I think it was those nurses he was burying in his backyard. you know, but if you don't actually see that, you don't suspect. And again, it would be unimaginable for anybody to suspect the kinds of thing Ed Gein was doing. So,
of course.
Yeah, because he was just inventing stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I think of him as a little bit of an outsider artist.
Oh, yeah. Very much so. Very outside. He's a solar system artist.
Yes. No, but, you know, Gein, again, is endlessly fascinating. And as you see in Murderabilia, a friend of mine came into possession of Augusta Gein's crucifix.
I saw that. I was going to ask you where that came from.
Yeah, he actually wrote me. I'm not sure how it happened. He was puzzled because apparently we reproduced the flip side of the crucifix. But in any case, where that came from was that Gein formed a friendship, an epistolary friendship. They, you know, just wrote letters to each other with some guy when he was in the last the institution that he was in until his death. They became very, very close pen pals. And at some point, Gein sent him as a gift Augusta's crucifix with a little card. I don't quite remember how my friend came into possession of it, but he purchased it from this other person, and he has Augusta's crucifix and the card, Ed Gein's card that, you know, that accompanied it. So,
God, I wonder what his signature was like. I just see it as like Ed, like just in block letters.
No. I mean, I've seen cards from him. You know, he had perfectly normal handwriting. You know, he was
that's kind of disappointing.
He was not a stupid man, Gein. You know, people saw him as a simple-minded kind of village idiot. But you know, when he was incarcerated, you know, he apparently read pretty widely. From what I know, from some people who interviewed him, he even read some Freud. And he was very
interesting.
Right. He's like, oh my God. Like the first, what? Oh no. Yeah.
Well, he was very dismissive of Freud's theory.
I imagine. He's like, that doesn't track for me.
Yeah, that complex stuff has nothing to do with me.
Yeah. Well, in Murderabilia, like one of the things I really appreciate about it is that, like, it's not, I kind of get the feeling from it, it's not just a history of true crime, but it's also like kind of a cultural history of like how people process true crime. The thing that I found most interesting, like the objects I found most fascinating weren't really the murder ballads, because of course I know a lot about murder ballads and it's great that those are included in there, but the kidnapping songs were... bizarre.
That's interesting.
Like, tell me a little bit about those. Like those were fascinating.
Well, the one I remember most, and again, as I think I said, before we started, as soon as I write a book, I forget everything that's in it, but remember that I do, include this little Charlie Ross, sheet music. I think it was called, the song was called something like, I Want to See Mama Again.
It's bizarre. It's called Bring Back Our Darling.
Was that the Charlie Ross one?
Okay. Yeah.
Wasn't there one like I Want to See Mama Again or something?
But there was a couple of them.
Yeah. It's the Fox.
Oh yeah, well that. But Charlie Ross was the first child who was kidnapped for ransom in the United States, and you know, the case became a big sensation. But you know, as you say, I mean, it says something about the culture of the time, and it's you know, love of these highly sentimental, you know, this highly sentimental poetry and music and so on and so forth, you know, that they turned this thing into a piece of sheet music. So you could, you know, take this music home and sit in your parlor and entertain family and friends,
God,
singing this heart-tugging song, you know, about this little missing kidnapped boy. But, you know, what you're saying is one of the things that, you know, is always, you know, I regard myself as a true crime historian. And one of the things I feel very strongly is you can learn a tremendous amount about any period in the culture by seeing which particular crimes you know, the public is fascinated and obsessed by at that moment. You know, for example, you know, one of the books I wrote was about the Bath school disaster of 1929, where this guy, you know, farmer named Andrew Kehoe, you know, blew up the town public school and killed 38 children and teachers and so on and so forth.
You know, I think we called him on the show the biggest asshole of the century.
And, you know, remains the worst school massacre in U.S. history. At the same time that was happening, you know, but, and it disappeared, you know, from public awareness within days. People just really weren't interested in it. But at the same time as happened, they were obsessed with the Ruth Snyder Judd Gray case, you know, the so-called double indemnity murder, where this housewife, Ruth Snyder, along with her kind of milquetoast lover boy, you know, conspired to murder Ruth's husband. And that, you know, that obsessed the public for months and months and months. You know, this guy blows up a school and kills 38 children, and the American public of the time shrugs it off. You know, the case with this woman, you know, who conspired with her, you know, adulterous lover to murder her husband, you know, become front page news for months. And it's because, you know, she embodied something, you know, that the public was, you know, very, very terrified at the moment. You know, she was this flapper, this 1920 flapper, you know, who was flaunting her sexual freedom.
Yeah. It's another moral panic.
It's juicy.
Exactly.
It's juicy. It's got
But she represented, you know, a threat to the whole Victorian domestic order, you know, that was being completely overthrown, you know, during the Jazz Age. You know, she came to embody that. You know, to some extent, the Leopold and Loeb also, you know, embodied the what they called the flaming youth of the time. You know, it wasn't that their crimes were so horrific. I mean, you know, she killed one person. Kehoe murdered 38 children. You know, she murdered, you know, this kind of bullying husband that she really had no relationship with. So it wasn't the horrificness of the crime. It's what she represented. So my point is, you know, you can learn, you know, you can learn, you learn as much about the 60s counterculture, you know, from looking at the Manson case, you know, as you can from looking at Woodstock.
Yeah, so, very interesting.
No, I'm just saying there's a sociological dimension to it, you know, as Marcus was saying.
It's the shadow. It's the understanding the shadow of a time period. I think that there, and it's what's in the shadow. I am in Jungian therapy. So the shadow is a lot longer than you think it is, right? The shadow actually encompasses quite a lot.
Yes, and Jung says the meeting with yourself is at first the meeting with your shadow.
Yeah.
Where you're in any kind of self-awareness, the first step is you have to be able to face your shadow. And of course, the shadow, you know, my classes, I would always tell my students, because I taught this course called Myth and Archetype for many years, you know, and I'd say, whatever is the most shameful, guilt-ridden thing you can say about yourself, you know, something you would never reveal even to your most intimate friend, is not the shadow. The shadow is something that is so abhorrent, you know, to everything you, you know, consciously think and all the values you hold, that you can't even admit it's part of yourself. And, you know, that again is something you confront, but it's necessary to confront that. And true crime, you know, is one of the ways that, you know, helps people come face to face with it, even though they don't, again, you know, not consciously, you know, consciously acknowledging that, again, they're dreaming those things that these wicked men are really doing. So.
Very interesting. Also, we're kind of hitting it now, too, because, you know, we cover what we call our terms of heavy hitters, like these kind of fascinating serial killer figures that we want to investigate. And we're discovering, because of the years we've been doing this, I feel like there are some crimes like the Bath School Massacre that are so bad. Mm-hmm. No one wants to get into it. Like, we're starting to come up against, well, like the guys that are kind of left that we're starting to kind of cover. Each one's worse than the last one.
Yeah.
You know, like we're having a hard time finding a proper source for the toolbox killers, right? And then it's because as soon as you look into it, you're like, oh, this is pretty unpleasant. Yeah. I could see why there's not a lot of focus on this story.
Yeah. Yeah, there was someone that you covered in the book, Gary Hynek. Is that Gary Hynek?
Yeah,
or that was I'd actually never heard about that story in the full detail. And, you know, it's about a man who, you know, kidnaps women and keeps them chained up in his basement. And one of them dies and he grinds her up into meat and feeds the remains to other women. I'd never heard of
that. Not cool.
Hynek had one of my two favorite defenses of any criminal. Hynek's defense, as you say, he lured these women into his home and chained them in the basement and tortured them in various ways. His defense when he was arrested was the women were there when he moved in.
Honestly, I was trying to get him to leave. Yeah. They didn't want to go.
My second favorite defense of all time was a few years ago, probably a decade or so ago, a woman, I think it was in Miami or somewhere in Florida, a woman collapsed on the street and this homeless guy immediately started sexually assaulting her. And his defense was, I thought she was dead.
What are you going to do, officer?
Yeah.
Honestly, what are we going to, and they're all like, we have to let him go. I thought she was dead. God, it takes every kind.
Yeah. Well, we just did a full series on necrophiliacs. We went real deep in the world of necrophilia.
Yeah, we went.
We went to all 10 subdivisions of necrophiliacs.
But there's something about that type of crime that's also very interesting, because unless it's tacked on to some other serious crime, like even other like serial murder, you don't hear a heck of a lot about it because it seems it's pretty gross.
Yeah.
Well, also, and necrophilia, I mean, there aren't really laws against it. I mean, there are laws against violating graves and so on and so forth. I'm not sure that there are specific.
I found 40 states have laws on the books about necrophilia, but there's no federal statute for it.
I think it's why droves of people are moving to Arkansas.
Stand corrected.
Wasn't on the books in California until 2004.
Oh, okay. Well, I've done some research into it. I mean, it was just rereading stuff about Sergeant Bertrand, who I'm sure you covered. We
absolutely did.
So I believe that was a case where somebody first coined the term necrophilia.
Yep.
Dude, again, you should do that book.
Yeah, bro. You should do that book.
Do that book. Honestly, I would love it. Can I just ask you to do various topics so that I can read more about them?
You know, there is a very good book on Bertrand, but it's in French. I'm sorry.
I can't read European.
Yeah, this is a question that we had on the show that maybe you can weigh in on, is that when we were putting together the story of necrophilia and putting together like a kind of a murderer's row of necrophiliacs, the majority of them were French. Why?
you know how the French feel about having sex with women.
They're very liberal.
Part of the I can only assume that it is part of the French attitude toward l'amour. You know, I know Pepe Le Pew was canceled recently.
Honestly, finally.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that had anything to do with that. But yes, I can't, it does.
You heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Harold Schechter says Pepe Le Pew is a necrophiliac.
I wouldn't put it past him.
I wasn't totally sure why he was canceled. I'm just throwing that out there.
He's a touchy.
He touches too much, yeah. Well, I mean, man, this has been so great. This has been so much fun.
This is so fucking great. Thank you so much for talking to us for so long. Do you want to talk about?
I mean, I know that you're right. You're working on another book right now, or you just finished it. You said 50 States of Murder.
50 States of Murder. So it's a book about what I tried to do in it was, there's very little about all the most notorious cases that are associated with certain states. you know, there's, I mean, because, you know, who needs to read more about Charles Manson or Jeffrey Dahmer or even Keane? So what I tried to do was write about crimes that are very, very notorious within each state, but are largely unknown to the rest of us. You know, crimes that have entered into the annals, criminal annals of the state, gone into the criminal lore of the state. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there are over 250 cases I cover, you know, and most of them were new to me, and many of them are very, very fascinating. Not sure exactly what the, I just handed the book in, not sure exactly. I'm thinking maybe it'll be out in 2025, but.
That's but, awesome.
I'm very, very proud of Murderabilia, and I'm really glad you guys liked it.
Oh, you love it.
Really glad you guys invited me to be on the show. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you guys.
You're the best. You're so good. Looking forward to the book. I'm looking forward to your book on necrophilia. I'm looking forward.
Actually, funny you say that. Eric Powell and I were actually thinking about doing a book on that subject, connecting it to Ed Gein. I'm not sure that that project is still a go. We're working on something else. But we did actually talk about necrophilia. You must know the case of Count von Kosel.
Yes, Carl Tanzler. That we
So
that's another. Talk about built for a comic book too.
Yeah,
that's great for a comic book.
Very visual.
So yeah, so Eric and I were batting that idea around. You know, I don't know if something will come of it or not. But
I'd love to see you guys collaborate again. Like, did you hear what Eddie Gein done? Was my favorite graphic novel of the year.
So it's good.
So good. So yeah, I'd love for you guys to. I'd vote yes. Over here.
Carl Tanzler, everyone's favorite romantic.
Marcus, just your favorite graphic novel of the year?
Okay, of all time.
See, so good. Shame him. Thank you, Mr. Schechter, for your wisdom and your time.
Thank you very much.
Live from your grave.
What a fascinating interview.
Always a fascinating time with our good friend Harold Schechter. We want to thank him so much for coming on to the show and gracing us with his presence. Once again, he's always a treasure guest and a treasured part of the true crime community.
He's wonderful. So check out his new book, Murderabilia, and check us out on twitch.tv/LPNTV. Coming to, we're going to be, obviously we're off this week, but we're going to be rolling back with new stuff and then a bunch of new shows in January, which I'm really excited for. Mm-hmm. And check out the Operation Sunshine number 2.
It is out in stores.
Yes,
right
so
now.
Get that in your local comic book store. We're going to Australia and New Zealand. Go check out our tour tickets at lastpodcastlive.com. It's going to be great. Can't wait. And hail, sweet Satan.
And hail, Keen. Why don't you?
Hail me, you turkeys.
You all you a bunch of turkeys.
You greasy turkeys.
You stuffins. You stuffins. What's wrong with the stuffins? You like it.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors, you can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.